I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. When Pete Crichton came of age in the 1980s, he lived in fear of being found out by friends and schoolmates. Being gay then felt like a death sentence, and living in the shadow of HIV/AIDS could have meant death as well. The balm to his pain was and remains music. In his new memoir, The Vinyl Diaries, Sex, Deep Cuts, and My Soundtrack to Queer Joy, Mr. Crichton, who joins me now, talks about the music that meant a lot to him growing up, that he revisits regularly and looks for meaning in from time to time. There's a great lesson in the book that anything worth its salt, music, literature, art itself, relationships, need to be cared for, listened to rigorously. It's music that he's shared with lovers and other strangers, and he does so in this book that often reads as a curated playlist. The book also chronicles how he struggles to make sense of his sexuality, how he entered two long-term monogamous relationships, and how they eventually failed in his early 40s as hookup cultures rise thanks to apps on one's phone surrounds our society. Pete goes through a midlife sexual awakening. He writes about that with great candor in the book. Frankly, his honesty in the book is refreshing, and the unapologetic way he finds love in all its forms could be seen as inspiring. It's worked for him. Pete Crichton has worked as a marketing executive in the arts for many years. He's studied comedy at Second City, graduating from their conservatory program in improv, scene writing, and performance. He sings in the Dolly Parton choir, the Tennessee Mountain Homos. This new book is published by Random House. He joined me from Toronto last week. Please welcome to the Planta on the program, Pete Crichton. Mr. Crichton, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. So the book is a collection of music that's been formative to you, as well as a catalog of a number of relationships over the years. A lot of these were casual, arranged through an app. For people listening to us, the casual sex might not be revolutionary, but you were in, I guess, if I might put this, in two monogamous relationships.
That's right.
You'd bought houses, I think, with both of these guys, did you?
That is right, yeah.
Yeah, and
didn't learn my lesson the first time.
And so you were in your early 40s when those relationships, collapsed, this coincided with the ubiquity of these hookup apps, right?
Yeah, sort of the perfect storm, I guess.
So for people listening to this who obviously haven't read the book yet, and we want them to as we chat, you call it a perfect storm. How does it feel, I mean, being that age in your early 40s? I'm in my early 40s now, and getting to any scene, not just the dating scene even, but any scene mm-hmm. altogether seems difficult enough. I mean, was that hard to navigate at first, say?
Yeah, I think a little bit, because it was just sort of like, it was just territory completely unknown to me. I think I had carried so much baggage and fear around sex for so long that just inherently the apps seemed like a dangerous place to go, and I really didn't understand the language or the situational things that happened, and they're not perfect by any means, but I know I was pretty lucky in the whole experience, but I really found them to be really joyful experiences, and that people were really open to connecting, not just sexually, but really emotionally, and making really profound connections sometimes in these encounters.
And then we'll talk about the music in a second, because in a lot of these relationships, the music adds another layer altogether, doesn't it, to the relationship itself?
For sure. To me, it did. And sort of that's, I tried to communicate that to the reader as best I could, and I hope that I did an okay job, but it sounds like you're picking up on it, so that's a good sign.
So you talk about the baggage. Your formative years were in the 1980s, and mm-hmm. That's the AIDS crisis, and you found being in the closet, not having sex with other people throughout the 1990s, was safer in it. I think you say this in the book, but you'll forgive me if I've inferred this, that mm-hmm. that probably saved your life, didn't it?
In a way, yeah, yeah. I don't know if I said it that overtly, but it definitely feels true. And, you know, it's funny, the book's only been out a couple weeks, but I've had people reach out to me and say very much what you've just said, is that, you know, they made the same choices and that they survived simply by, like, being like not having sex, losing my words today, and that that choice saved them. And I definitely feel like that's part of my choice because, you know, we forget back then how much misinformation there was around HIV/AIDS.
Yeah.
We just didn't know how it was, how it was transferred, how it was communicated. Was it by touch? Was it by, you know, airborne? There was just all this crazy information out there. So it really was terrifying for a generation of us who, you know, were just too young to be having sex. I mean, forget about how terrifying it was for the men who were living and experiencing it. But for those of us who watched, it was just a very different kind of experience.
Yeah, the misinformation about AIDS, I mean, looking back as I was reading the book, all these myths that we were told, say, growing up. I was in elementary school at the time, and I remember some of those things that were being said, you know, to warn us, if you will. You know, it just, you know, these things didn't bear out to be true, did they?
No, some, no. But, you know, but others did, obviously. So, you know, but the time that I was coming out and really understanding my sexuality, none of those understandings were available to us. So I just shut down, and that fear stuck with me for decades.
So the 1980s, you know, some of the first people, you know, we heard getting AIDS and dying of it. I think of Rock Hudson, for example. Freddie Mercury was a little later.
Yeah.
Do you think if they had disclosed that they were gay or queer, do you think that would have been easier for younger people like yourself?
Oh, for sure. You know, we were confused by some of the HIV and AIDS misinformation, but boy, were we confused by a lot of the pop stars of the day, like Freddie Mercury, like Elton John, who married a woman in 1985, I think it was. You know, George Michael was in the closet. Even Boy George was sort of like really coy about sex in general. And it just, I sort of thought to myself, well, if these guys aren't gay, like, what the heck? Like, it just was such a confusing thing for me to try to work through. And I thought, well, if they can't say that they're gay, and we were all pretty sure that they were, how can I? You know, they had agency, they had money, they had fame, they had power. And I was just this dumb kid in high school. So having that role model or that one person of that stature come out and say, you know what, I am gay, everyone, like, surprise, would have been such a landmark shift, I think, for me and for a lot of young gay men at the time.
You also write in that part of the book that we didn't have a good understanding of AIDS until straight people started dying of AIDS, you know, people like Ryan White, even Magic Johnson disclosing having HIV. That really didn't, it didn't hit home for a lot of people, I guess, until those people got AIDS, right?
Yeah, yeah. There was sort of so much stigma. I mean, there was sort of like, I remember I recently watched a news clip on ABC News from the time, and it was like the four H's, like there were homosexuals, and then they were talking about Haitians and drug users. I can't remember how they were an H, you know, and with sort of like these at-risk populations that they just kind of lumped in all together, and it felt like they were really pigeonholing this as something that happened to niche populations by sort of some of the language that they were using. And that niche is not the right word, but I'm hoping that you understand what
yeah,
I mean.
Yeah.
And then to me, as you know, as rethinking it from this perspective from 2025, it was definitely like, it does seem like the real shift in education and funding happened around that Ryan White time and when some of the sort of more, lack of a better word, just white folks, middle class, getting the disease. And that sort of seemed to be when the governments and researchers started paying more attention.
The book opens with a scene in March of 2020 when you're with friends and your boyfriend, Christopher, is outwardly demonstrative in affection, PDA as they call it. And you write, even at that point, you're still getting used to it. I mean, you grew up, I guess, as someone who that wasn't common, I guess. And I mean, this does say something about our culture, doesn't it, our society, that it's come so far in some places, I guess, right? I mean, that was a safe space for all of you, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it felt safe. We were in downtown Toronto at a queer bar. So, you know, it felt like there were some protections in that space. But yeah, that was not something when I was growing up that I even considered a possibility in my lifetime, let alone in the 80s or 90s. Just that kind of demonstration of same-sex desire would have, like, 100% been bullied or, you know, even worse than bullied, incited violence.
Yeah.
So to be able to do it in the book and at that time was really still revolutionary to me. And it, you know, even then caused me some discomfort in a gay space. I've gotten over that considerably over the past few years, but.
But there's also the discomfort, knowing what's going on around you and around the world at the time in March of 2020. Some people drew parallels to the AIDS crisis during the COVID pandemic. I mean, did you think that was well-founded, say?
Yeah, very much. I felt that for sure, very quickly. 'Cause again, there was, you know, especially at the onset of COVID, there was, again, so much miscommunication. There was a lack of understanding of how it was transmitted. It was potentially deadly. Don't meet people. Don't talk to people. And then all of a sudden, that idea of meeting strangers or having sex again became this potentially deadly thing. So it definitely sparked some feelings in me that I, you know, at the time really wasn't ready to confront. You know, and then as it went on, it was still, you know, there advertising case counts and testing positive and all this language that was just so familiar to me from that time. It definitely brought up a lot of feelings around HIV/AIDS for me.
The music that you heard in your childhood home, I'm curious to know, it's probably a lot different than the music that you talk about in the book. So is there a connection? I mean, do you think that music that your parents heard, listened to, say, did that shape the music you love today?
Probably in some ways, yeah. I mean, I think maybe when I was younger, you know, as a teenager, you always rebel against what your parents like. I think that's just part of the process. But, you know, very young, you know, my dad would play his record collection, which was like Shirley Bassey and some of these sort of like jazz singers. And I still have some of his Ella Fitzgerald records and these interesting jazz instrumental records. And my mom was more like Barbra Streisand and Neil Diamond. And, you know, I didn't love those things at the time, and I still don't. But I think, you know, you're taking in all those influences and sort of making selections about what you like or what you don't like. And, you know, I can still hear some of those songs, and just like, it's just an immediate sensorial, it just takes you right back to when you were a kid in the living room. And, you know, for me, I see the wallpaper, I see the rug, I see the stereo, I see my parents moving around the room. It just is this very vivid, movie-like memory for me.
You know, you mentioned Barbra Streisand, and that's one of the things that one will get out of the book, is that I guess the music that you like isn't that sort of stereotypically gay music that I think a lot of us perceive.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like show tunes
and
popular music, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. All the divas, all the Barbaras. It definitely put me at odds with the gay community for a long time.
Even now?
To be honest. Even now, for sure. Like, I don't care about Lady Gaga, and that sort of feels like a radical position in the gay community, but it's just who I am, and I cannot pretend otherwise.
The thing that struck me as I was reading the book about the music and like one aspect of it. I mean, you talk about the art of the mixtape.
Yeah,
curating a playlist comes close, but it's not the same, is it?
Absolutely not. No, it's too easy. You know, I think for those of us who did go through it, you know, it sounds like you might have just missed the mixtape experience based on
we had CDs growing up, and that was hard enough, you know.
It was hard enough, for sure. But the making a tape experience is very, it's so laborious and really was a labor of love and a huge effort. And, you know, to make one for someone, whether that was a friend or someone you had a crush on, was just really this demonstration of, I care about you. So I carry around a box of those that friends would mail me from far off places, and it just was a really beautiful way to connect, and you knew that someone really put effort into it. So it to me feels so much more effortful, for lack of a better word, than like just clicking a few buttons on a CD playlist or a Spotify playlist.
Do you still play the tapes?
Yeah, you know what? In COVID, when I had time and the energy to do it, I found an old tape deck, and it's a little wonky, and, you know, it didn't play back, like, very well. But I still would, I listened to a couple, and, like, I remember what track is next. I remember the mood I was trying to set. Like, it was a very vivid sensorial experience going back to some of those things.
That's the great thing that comes through in the book is how our memories are shaped by the music we like the first time, say, we heard a song or an album. I mean, mm-hmm. you talk in the book about the first album that you spent your own money on. I mean, that's the sort of stuff you don't forget, is it?
Absolutely. Never. Never, ever. I think I'll go to the grave with that B-52's record, which is the one you reference. It just, it's so meaningful to me, and it's, you know, I sort of thought I was an island in this experience, and because I'm a huge record collector still, I listen to music constantly. But people have surprised me, like way more casual music listeners are like, oh man, this book is resonating so much with me. I remember going to that store with my babysitting money or whatever it was, how they got their money to buy their first record. And I love that people are sharing those stories. It feels like such a gift and an honor to hear all of them.
Yeah, see, I don't listen to the kind of music that you listen to, but I've over the, thanks to, you know, having a subscription to Apple Music, I'm able to dial up these things right away as I'm reading them and hear them and add them to a playlist even. That's a fun part about this book, is that in a way you're introducing the reader to a lot of music that they might not have otherwise listen to, or the best thing about the book is when there's a song that we probably know, we probably never liked, but because you explain it to us, you know, and what it meant to you, or even just, I can't remember now the name of the song, but there's something where you go into the history of it and the making of it. It made me appreciate it more when I went to my phone and listened to it. I'm sure a lot of readers probably will be telling you that as they read the book.
Oh, that's so great. Thank you, Joe. That's my dream scenario, is that someone's reading this book and is inspired to actually go and listen to some of the songs or artists I'm referencing, especially those ones who aren't as well known. So I really hope that's part of the experience for a lot of people.
You know, you write in the book about the work that one should do when they're listening, there are certain records that you say should be listened to carefully, because they yield something important. And, you know, I couldn't help but think, you know, because you write this in the book, that this applies to, say, books, art, friendships, and relationships. I mean, we do have to put the work into it, because I think that's the thing when you talk about these apps. It's so instant that we overlook the hard work that obviously has to be done, right?
Absolutely. In so many things, you know, and there's like a real listening thing on some of these albums, and I think it's one or two of the Kate Bush stories that I am maybe a little bit too pedantic about saying, like, stop, listen, turn off your phone, do the thing, light a candle. But there is something about sort of ritualistic about just sitting down, and whether it is a book, whether it's a record or whether it's some piece of art you're digesting, it's to really take time out of your day and spend time with it, is it can be so rewarding. But we're just so distracted by all the little buzzes and beeps on our phones and our whatevers that we lose it. And I think we are losing so much appreciation for art, appreciation for just a singular experience, because our attention spans are just shrinking so quickly. Mine included. I'm not trying to say I'm above it all, but it's a bit of a scary time, and what our little phones and devices have done to our brains is wild.
Yeah, I'm starting to look at that that thing that the iPhone does and tells you how many hours you spent.
Yeah.
I used to find that annoying, and now I'm just like, well, it's annoying probably for a reason. When you when you see that number at the end of the week or whatever, whenever it pops up, just how much time we're spending on these devices.
Yeah, and what else could we have been doing for those hours, you know? It's pretty amazing.
Well, in the book, there's a lot of sex, and so this got me thinking, you know, as to why I would assume some straight people resent gay people, is that the gay people are probably having more sex than we're having.
I don't know if that's true, but it might be. People have suggested that to me based on their experience. So, you know, I don't think it's anything to be mad about. We can all choose what we want to choose in our life, you know. But you might be onto something there for sure.
The other thing, I'm halfway through the book. The thing that I can't wrap my head around is the idea of open relationships. Now, I'm not naive to think that straight people aren't, you know, engaging in extracurricular sex. But the idea of the open relationship, because, I mean, there's some guys that you hooked up with on the apps that are in committed relationships and yet still do the hookup thing. Is that I don't know how to put this, is that easier in the gay community? I mean, is monogamy less of a problem in the gay community than it is in the straight community?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should have a panel of straight people and gay people to have this in, to be fair. But, you know, I think partly it's easier for men for whatever reason, and I wish I had another woman on this call to speak and have that voice. But I do think for whatever reason, for men, it's easier to separate sort of sex from safety, from a relationship. And again, that's a very broad, there are women out there who are as sexually voracious and
sure,
lots of partners.
Yeah.
But I just think as a rule, that's probably true. It does seem like so much of culture is shaped by gay and queer people that, you know, I hope that the conversation around open relationships and or non-monogamy, you know, continues. And, you know, I'm not saying it's for everyone, but I think it's maybe something people should talk about and think about.
Yeah, I mean, I reference those two previous relationships in your 30s. I mean, those were monogamous relationships, and I don't know if I'd be right to draw the conclusion that they broke down because you were looking for something else.
Yeah, you know, I think I was definitely looking for something else. I don't know that it was...
You're looking for a different person, maybe, but not the sort of the what you stumbled upon with these apps, right?
Totally. Yeah, it wasn't, you know, those relationships didn't end because I was trying to find a new sexual identity or I wanted to have more sexual partners. It was just more that these don't fit for me in the way that I feel comfortable anymore. So that was more the cause for ending those than, oh my God, I want to get out there and have a ton of sex. Because at that time, it still terrified me.
Yeah. The other thing that broke my heart as I was reading the book was when you talked about not feeling attractive, or I should say that you weren't told that you were attractive until quite late in your life. It was a guy named Dave, I guess, who told you that. And and I kept wondering, do you think realizing that and hearing that for the first time, say, that you were robbed of something, that not having been told that earlier?
Yeah, I think you know, I'd probably been told it before, but I didn't feel it. How about that? I think Dave was the one who made me feel it for sure. And that was partly because he was such an attractive individual. I was sort of like, what are you doing with me? Why? I don't understand this. But I think, you know, that the damage that happens to a lot of queer people when they live in the closet for a really, really long time, it just, it affects our self-confidence, it affects our self-perception, and, you know, that I just didn't have confidence in any area of my life, let alone how I looked. That is just, it's one of the outcomes of living in the closet for a long time for me. So hearing that from someone, you know, especially in my mid-40s, when I was sort of taught to believe, like, your sexual agency is over by the time you turn 40, was like a real light bulb moment for me of like, wow, what if I am? Like, it was sort of like a realization that maybe it is possible that someone in their mid-40s can be sexually attractive.
And you also write in the book that age doesn't matter, because, I mean, a lot of the relationships that you talk about in the book were with, say younger men. I wondered, the idea of age not mattering, was that easier to realize because you were usually the older one?
Interesting. I guess, yeah. Yeah, I think what, you know, I never ever, you know, I didn't see it in popular culture. I never read things about these sort of, I mean, there are books about May-December romances between men, but, you know, when I was hearing from 23 and 25-year-old men when I was in my 40s was just like, huh, that's not something I was expecting in my life. And it was a really beautiful surprise, and I was mentored by those younger guys as much, if not more, than me mentoring them. And sharing stories and our life experiences was this really profound thing for me. And, you know, that sort of opened up my ideas of like, oh, truly, like, age really doesn't matter in these relationships. And it, you know, I didn't date a lot of older guys, but now, you know, that isn't something that I worry about at all anymore. It's just about, you know, connection between two people, and that can happen between people of any age.
And it's delightful to see when you're with, say, a younger guy, and you're talking about music, and they're excited to see the collection of LPs, and they have some knowledge of some of the music that you like. Unfortunately, because their parents had listened to an album. But
yeah,
beyond that, when you're talking about the songs themselves or the music or the creation of the piece of artwork, it's delightful to see that connection between the two of you.
Yeah, it surprised me, to be honest, Joe. I didn't expect it, but I think what really fascinated a lot of these men was just the physical presence of media. You know, so many people now grow up without any hard media in their homes, whether it's records or books or, like, it's just all consumed online. So there was sort of this automatic fascination when people would see my record collection, which is sizable, and sort of go, whoa, what is this? And then, you know, as they sort of dig through it, they're like, oh, I've heard of this record. Tell me about this. And the record itself became this really interesting totem for sharing stories and talking about our lives and talking about the artist in question and how they influenced queer culture or influenced me. And that's sort of how the book started to develop, was just through those conversations.
As you've written the book and talk about it now since it's been published, can you look back and discern how your tastes in music have changed? I mean, as you get older, are you more or less, say, tolerant of new music?
No, I don't think so. You know, when I think about that, I never liked pop music very much. Like, listening to the radio as a kid, it just, top 40 stuff was not interesting to me. And, you know, that's still true. Most popular music today just doesn't interest me. It seems so, you know, I like to find more people who are pushing the envelope, who are, you know, creating artistic statements rather than trying to sell records, or, you know, someone trying something new is always going to be fascinating to me. And I try to keep as open mind as possible. The trouble for me is I don't listen to a lot of radio for music. So I buy records, and so and they've become so expensive the past couple of years that sort of limited my consumption of new music. But I'm open to it, and I love a discovery of a new record or a new artist.
And so are you going to the record store every week or regularly if, during the month and buying this stuff that you want to listen to, say?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, the prices have become astronomical, yeah. So it's definitely less. But I still love just going and sort of flipping through and seeing what's on the shelf. And, you know, I'm more inclined to buy the $3 or $4 record that I've never heard of that's, you know, probably 30 years old. But that still, there's fun discovery in that. And it's like, oh, my God, I never heard of this artist. That's pretty cool. And they're great.
Are you the sort of guy that goes to, say, a garage sale or thrift store and look through the box of records that's there?
Oh, if I see a box, there's no way I'm not stopping to have a look. Absolutely. My partner gets driven mad sometimes, but I got to look. You never know what's there.
Yeah. The book also lovingly pays tribute to a lot of places in Toronto that aren't around anymore, spaces that were important venues. That were more than just, say, places to gather or listen to music or drink or be with people. These are places that shape identity and community. I guess that was something important you wanted to also include in the book, right?
Yeah. I don't know if it was conscious at first, but, you know, the more I was rereading and writing more, it was like, oh, that space is gone. Oh, Lipstick and Dynamite's gone. Oh, the Beaver's gone. It sort of it became more apparent to me as I was writing it than I actually actively intended to do. But yeah, I think in Toronto, there's just this great loss of queer spaces, that I don't know what to do about, you know, it's sad. And I think part of it is the app. So, you know, that's definitely a downside to some of these beautiful relationships I built there. But yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, there's this rejection of apps or online communities and people just get out in the world and start supporting queer spaces again.
Yeah. I guess that happens not just in Toronto, but other big cities all over.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. The men depicted in the book that you write about, like I used the name Dave earlier for one of the guys. I mean, did you have to change names as you were writing the book, say?
There definitely were a few I changed, you know, where relationships ended badly, like Dave, for example. But for the most part, you know, while I was writing the book, I would sort of reach out to somebody and say, like, hey, I'm writing this book, and I'm sharing some of these stories. Are you comfortable with that? And, you know, 9 out of 10 were like, oh, my God, what a great honor, please. And I had changed every single name in the book, and I was really shocked that most of the men were like, why don't you just use my name? I was like, great, okay. You know, I hadn't really considered that. And we had my book launch in Toronto at the Lula Lounge 2 weeks ago, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think there were 8, maybe 9 of the men in the book who came out to support the launch and who were there and who were named in the book. So, you know, that really gave my heart a boost. It's like, I guess I've done this well, and been fair and careful with how I told these stories, which was a nice feeling.
So have you heard from a lot of people as a result of the book being out now?
Yeah, almost every day I get this cool message from someone saying like, oh, I just read your book and it's resonating with me deeply and I had an experience like this and I had a Dave or I, you know, had a relationship like this. And it's so heartwarming to hear because, you know, it's a very personal and a very vulnerable book. So I was terrified these past few weeks leading up to the launch. So hearing from people that it's connecting and resonating with them is just wonderful for me.
By the way, I meant to look this up online. I better just ask you. Is there a playlist of some sort on either Spotify or Apple of the songs that you talk about in the book in one place, say?
Yeah, there is, actually. I don't like using streamers, but my publisher was very keen for me to have a public playlist of all the songs.
Uh-huh.
So every chapter is named after a song, so there is a playlist of all the chapter headings on Spotify under my username, PETCRI.
Pete, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. I can't tell you how much I got out of the book.
Thank you.
And congratulations and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Joe, so much. I appreciate your time, too. It's been great talking to you.
The book is called The Vinyl Diary, Sex, Deep Cuts, and My Soundtrack to Queer Joy. It's published by Random House Canada. Its author, Pete Crichton, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.